All right, we're sort of following this book, How to Influence Friends and Tactfully Get Along with People. We're looking at what Paul did when he wrote a letter to Philemon. And the first section of that letter, Paul builds the relationship before he deals with the conflict or the potential conflict. So we're at number three. Communicate that you both need God's grace. Philemon verse 3. Grace and peace to you from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, perhaps this was a greeting. Paul used it several other places. We see someone and we say hi, or how are you? And a lot of times it's just a greeting. It doesn't really mean what it says. But I think Paul specifically puts this here because of the word grace. He's highlighting to Philemon that, look, we're both saved by grace, and we need to understand that before we get into this. The implications of grace, number one, I'm not perfect. And so I'm bringing a problem, and I may skew it. I may see a problem when there is no problem, or I may communicate in some ways that I think you're the problem. But I could be wrong about that. I'm not perfect. But number two, you're not perfect either. I'm not perfect. You're not perfect. So we have two non-perfect people who need the grace of God in their lives discussing an issue. Or number three, who am I to criticize you? And number four, who are you to criticize me? Nobody likes unwanted, unasked for criticism. So if Paul just came in, with his letter and said, all right, I got a problem with you with Onesimus, and here it is. No, when we say something, and a lot of times when we give someone criticism, if we're asked why we did it, we would say, well, I'm doing it for their own good. When we talk to our kids, hey, do this, don't do it this way. Or the boss talks to his employees and he's, sort of directing them. Or a coach, or a person in church. Or a person will come up to me after a sermon. I remember a couple of years ago, someone came up and said to me, you may want to rethink that whole sermon after you read this book that I just read. Now, they could have said it in a nice way. They could have just said, hey, great sermon. In fact, I just read a book that's on that you might be excited to read about. I mean, they could have done it that way. But instead, they said, you might want to rethink your whole sermon. I mean, so I just spent, 10 hours making it. Now I've delivered it. I've done the best that I can. And the first thing I hear is that I should just start all over. It feels, when you get unasked for unwanted criticism, it feels like sabotage. You've worked hard at something. You think, perhaps that it's good or you've done a good job, and then someone torpedoes what you just did. Or number two, it's often in public, which is embarrassing. When that person said I should read this book, there were three people standing around, the three people that I know well, and they just rolled their eyes at this person because, we're all embarrassed because of it. Number three, it automatically triggers a defensive attitude. A person isn't ready for criticism. It comes out of the blue. And all of a sudden it hits you, and the first thing you want to do is defend yourself. Number four, it kicks in the part of the brain that controls one's lawyer instincts. If someone says something, I want to say something back. Generally, because a person, when they criticize someone, they just say what the criticism is. They don't give their whole thinking. They don't give the grounds. They don't give the whole history behind it, things that they have seen and known before. In other words, they don't give you any of the background to their thoughts. They have judged you and they have condemned you without you even being there for the trial. And all you get is the verdict delivered. And so, of course, you're like, hold it. When was I even on trial? And number five, at worst, it takes away motivation to change. When people criticize, when they're told what they've done wrong, it just brings out anger. And now all my energy is going to anger. It's going into my defense. And I'm not really thinking about what I should do or what I should change. So if people don't like unwanted, unasked for criticism, why do we do it? Why do we criticize people? Number one, it's been done to us by parents, teachers, coaches, bosses, spouses, children, pastors, members. People do it to us all the time. As a parent, you're constantly telling your children, look, put your clothes on, do this, do that. No, don't do it that way. No, you get your shoes on backwards. You know, we're constantly correcting and directing our children at almost every step. If you were to just listen in a day to all the words that you say to your own children, most of it is correcting and directing. So we've grown up with it. Then you go to school. And teachers are telling you, you know, you make a report, you do a test, and their red marks all over the test are telling you that you did it wrong. You go on the playing field, you join a team, and they tell you you're holding the bat wrong, you're kicking the soccer ball wrong. This is how you do it. Now, all these people are trying to help, but we grow up with a constant barrage of people telling us that we're not doing it right. So we live under constant criticism. So we do the same with the people around us. Number two, why do we criticize people? It's easy to think that I am right and you are wrong on almost any topic. I mean, whatever I think about a topic is what I think. And why would I think a particular thing on a topic, something that I think is wrong? So, of course, what I think about every topic is right. Now, I might not be as confident as some might be on a particular topic, but in general, people tend to think that they're right with the way they're thinking. They grow up a certain way. They grow up with certain expectations. The people around me think this. So when you meet someone that doesn't think that way, it's like, you must be wrong. Number three, we genuinely want to help someone, and we feel we can quickly help them with a few words of a correction, no big deal. So I had a friend back when I was a teenager, just learning how to drive, and I had to, you know, we'd go somewhere. He lived one direction, I lived another direction, and we'd always meet in the middle, and then one of us would drive. And he was late every time. I mean, if we were going to meet at 1 o'clock, he would get there at 1:30. So finally, I just, you know, I thought, we should just clear this up in a minute. You know, look, you're always 20 minutes late. And I thought, you know, we're going to have a 30-second conversation. Done. But he got all defensive. What do you mean? Sometimes I have to wait for you. And da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And we had this big thing. And it didn't correct a thing. And even to this day, he's a half an hour late to whatever it is that we do. So I'm thinking, this is no big deal. I'm thinking I can just offer my 2 cents. I see something wrong. I see that in sports all the time. You're playing a game, and I can see that you're struggling. And so let me give you a helpful hint or a helpful tip. Now, you didn't ask for that tip. And generally, people, it becomes more of a deal than we think it's going to be. Number four. What the other person has been doing has been bugging us for a long time, and finally we can't take it anymore. So, you know, my friend, he's late, and finally I'm sitting there waiting for 20 minutes, half an hour, and I can't take it anymore. So I'm a little upset, and so I can't help but communicate that to him. Criticizing others, number five, criticizing others puts us into the superior role in a relationship and often makes us feel good about ourselves. If I'm the one correcting and directing you, that I am the one that's sort of in charge. I am the leader. So we end up criticizing people even though it doesn't really work. Why criticism does not help correct anything and often makes relationships worse than before. Number one. Though you've been thinking long and hard about the criticism you want to give someone, the receiver of your criticism is in no way prepared to receive it. So, you know, if I have a problem with something, I've been thinking about it. I've been praying about it. I've rehearsed conversations in my mind over and over about this. And all of a sudden, you know, finally, I let you in on all this thinking. Now, you haven't been thinking about this. You haven't rehearsed it. You haven't prayed about it. And I just come in with all my thinking and, you know, all my criticisms towards you, and I'm ready and I'm prepared and I have grounds and I have reasons and I have examples ready to go. And you're like, you haven't thought about it. And you want to, hold it, you know, I want as much time as you've had to think about this, to think about it and then give you my response. Number two, unless you've communicated to this person a whole lot of encouraging words previously, the person receiving your criticism will doubt your motives in the giving of your criticism. I think, you know, researchers have studied this, that for every one word of criticism or correcting or directing that you give to someone, that you should have seven positive things that you have said in the past. It's a 7-to-1. Probably it's the other way around. We probably criticize and direct and, you know, tell people, you know, our thoughts all the time, probably 7 times to every 1 time we say something encouraging to them. Number three, people do not see themselves as needing correction. Dale Carnegie, in his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, he starts the book off with the story of Two Gun Charlie, or some gangster from the 20s, who you know, had killed people and, you know, robbed banks and all of this. And he was in a house, and he was surrounded by all the policemen, and they were shooting their guns. And so he thinks he's going to get killed, and so he writes his last will and testament. And he writes, you know, what he's going to give to who and so on. But in the end, he says, you know, and all this to a person who never would hurt anyone. I mean, he had killed people, but he didn't see himself that way. And Dale Carnegie made the point. Now, if a guy like this doesn't see that he is guilty of anything, that he needs correction, someone like this doesn't think that, what does the average person think of themselves? The average person does not see that they need all kinds of correction. Well, when does criticism work? Number one, when you have a relationship with someone that you've built up over a long period of time, because they know that you care about them. Number two, when it is done with the sense that I could be wrong. So, I'm a pastor. I went to school for college for 4 years. I went to seminary for 4 years. I've been preaching for 30 years. And yet, I'll still have someone come up to me after a sermon sometimes. And they'll start telling me how I missed a point and how I got it all wrong. And they will say it like, this is the way it is. Like, this is fact. Now, I understand that this is what they think. And, of course, people can think anything. And you know what? I could be wrong. But they're coming to me as if there's no question about, you know, this is what they think, and they think I'm wrong, and that's the way it is. And it always amazes me. Well, have you gone to seminary? Have you studied all these? It doesn't mean that I can't be wrong, but just a little humility. Like, you know, I could be wrong, but this is what I think. I mean, just that phrase alone would help. Number three, criticism works when it's done with humility. Look, neither of us is perfect, and both of us stand in need of grace. I need grace, you need grace, and so there's this thing, it's come up, it might be a problem, I don't know, can we talk about it? See, if you come in with a little bit of humility, if you come into a problem or a potential problem, a conflict with someone, with a little bit of grace, I could be wrong. I could have misinterpreted everything. I could have missed the whole point. You could too. So, you know, we have to talk with each other. We have to sort of go back and forth to sort of figure this out. And probably it's just a big misunderstanding. It's not that you're wrong and I'm right. You know, we don't have to play that. We don't have to be competitors. Number four, when does criticism work? It works when the ground rules of a relationship have been established and agreed upon. Ground rules that give permission for correction, suggestion, or even criticism if it's done with respect and honor. You know, when you join a team, you know, a sporting team, in a sense, when you join, when you sign up, you're saying to the coach, look, I give you permission to criticize me. I give you permission. I expect it that when you see something that I'm not doing right, I give you permission to call me out on it. See, now I'm ready. And I think we you know, we have that sort of understanding with maybe teachers, in some ways with parents. But it has to be said We have to understand that I am asking for it. If you just give unwanted criticism where there's no expectation of it, people will often not listen. So Philemon, so Paul goes on in verse 4. I always thank my God as I remember you in my prayers. So he talks about God's grace, and then he goes on to say, I always thank my God as I remember you in my prayers. We're still in part 1, build a relationship. Number 4, communicate that you thank God for the other person. Paul did this a lot in his letter to the Philippians, verse 3. I thank my God every time I remember you. Colossians 1, verse 3. I always thank God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, when we pray for you. 1 Thessalonians. We always thank God for all of you and continually mention you in our prayers. 2 Thessalonians. We ought always to thank God for you, brothers and sisters, and rightly so, because your faith is growing more and more, and the love of all you have for one another is increasing. For 2 Timothy 1, verse 3, I thank God whom I serve as my ancestors did with a clear conscience, as night and day I constantly remember you in my prayers. So this was a thing that Paul constantly did. Well, what does thanking God do for someone? Number one, thanking God for someone helps you start to think of positive things about this person. So if you start thanking God for someone that you don't like very well, or someone that is in conflict with you, they don't like you very well, it's easy to think of all the things that separate you and all the problems and conflicts and potential conflicts that you have. That's what, you know, goes back and forth in your mind. You see this person, and right away you think, I wonder what they're going to say. They start walking towards you, and you wonder what negative thing they're going to say. It's easy to think of all these negative things. But if you go to God in prayer, and the first thing you have to do is somehow thank God for that person, that's hard. And you have to start thinking of positive things. Well, he seems to treat his kids okay. I thank God he's a good parent. You have to work at it. Generally, we work at thinking of the negative things. But here, you're forced. The thanking of God for this person forces you to start thinking of the positive things that this person has. And if you could think of a few of those, maybe something good will happen in the relationship. What does thanking God do for someone? Number two, thanking God for someone forces you to humble yourself before God in regard to this person. When you're thinking negatively about someone, they have problems that should be corrected, and you stand as the judge over them. Whenever you start thinking negatively of people, you rise up above them. But when you have to thank God for them and you think of positive things for someone that you don't get along with very well, all of a sudden you have to humble yourself before God. The thanking process. Number one, pray for people on a regular basis. If you just prayed for people in general on a regular basis, you'll have a more positive relationship with them. So pray for your family, your friends, your organization. If you're in a church, pray for your church directory. Just haul out the directory. Every day, pray for a list. By name, think about each one of these people. Number two, pray for problem people in your life. These are the people you don't like very well. These are the people that you have conflict with. These are the people that are maybe negative on you. Pray especially for them. And number three, pray for people you want to resolve things with. You have these issues. There's potential problems. That's what Paul's doing. He's writing to Philemon. They got this problem with Onesimus. How's it going to go? I don't know. But I want you to know, Philemon, before we get into all that, that I thank God for you. I pray to God for you. And I thank God. I'm telling you, when people know that they're being prayed for, it makes a big difference. So the thanking process. So number one is pray for the people on a regular basis. Number two, communicate in some way that you are praying for them. There's praying for people, and you can do that privately. But somehow you need to let the people in your life know that you are actually praying for them. In the church plant that I did in Vancouver, we moved to a new place. We got a new office. and it was below a sound booth. I write that in this book, example of Tom. Tom was the owner of this sound studio, and I was fascinated with that whole process, and I liked him. He didn't want to come to church. He wasn't a believer, but we talked often. And one day he was telling me how his sister was sick and she had to go to the hospital and there were some tests and he was quite worried about her. So I said, oh, okay, well, I'll put her down in my axe. And then I didn't say anything and he didn't dare to ask anything, so I just left it there. My axe was a little book that we had made, and in that little book was my to-do list, everything I was going to do for the day, but also my prayer thing, which was acts, adoration, confession, thanksgiving, supplication. And every day I would write down my prayers in this little book, and I called it my acts. So I prayed for Tom and his sister every day, and I wrote that down. A week later, I saw him, and I said, so how did that thing with your sister go? He said, oh, the reports came back. It was something else. It was something fixable, and we're greatly relieved. And I said to him, well, I'm not surprised, because I put you and her in my axe. And he finally had the courage to say, well, what is this axe thing? I didn't know what you said a week ago. I still don't know what that is. So I had her with me. So I showed him. I said, well, it's my prayer journal. And every day I write things down. And so last week when we talked, I wrote, you know, under supplication, a prayer for you and your sister. And the next day, I wrote it again. And the next day, I wrote it again. And then I just showed him the whole week with his name right there in my prayer journal. Now, I'm telling you, you know, people say, well, I'll pray for you, but you don't really know and you don't really expect that they're going to do it. But when you're reading your name in someone's journal and you see it every day, then you know that they were actually praying. And because of that, he said, you know what? Do you have copies of that? Because I'd like to try that too. And eventually he ended up coming to our church. You can pray for people, but people need to really know that you are actually praying for them. And what does that do? That makes them more inclined towards you. What does bringing up people's names before God communicate to these people? Number one, that you deem them worthy of mention before the Creator and Sustainer of the universe. You see, you're building them up. When they find out that you've been thanking God for them in your prayers, it's like, wow. It's like, you know, if I met the Queen of England and, you know, I had a little time with her and I ended up talking about you. Number two, that you seek to honor them. I honor you as a child of God. So get out a list. Start praying for people. Write down, especially the people that you struggle with or people that you may have a conflict with before you go into the conflict, before the conflict arises, before you deal with a thing that you know there might be some hard feelings, but you know you have to do it. Maybe it's someone at work that you work with and there's this thing and there's tension and it's building and you know you're going to have to do something. Before you do that, start praying for them. Thank God for them. And then communicate that in some ways. And then somewhere down the road, you can talk about that.